Welcome to this session. This session is on the role of the regulator in injury schemes, and our presenters today are the three gentlemen beside me from Ernst & Young, who of course are our platinum sponsors, so thank you again for that. I would have thought that would get you out of presenting papers, but evidently not. You guys have been pretty busy with papers during the conference. So our three presenters today, to my left immediately is Peter McCarthy, who probably needs little introduction to most of you, one of the I could say an eminence grease of accident compensation now, Peter, as a partner in the actuarial and insurance services division of the Financial Services Group at Ernst & Young, and also the current convener of the Institute of Actuaries General Insurance Practice Committee. To Peter's left is Bevan Dam, probably doesn't need any introduction either. You remember his balloons on his head from last night. Bevan is a director in the same practice and has worked extensively in the compensation sector, particularly in the New South Wales schemes, motor accidents and workers' comp. And the last gentleman on the left is Andrew Doman. Andrew is a senior manager in the group, qualified actuary with 8 years' experience in injury schemes and broader insurance. And Andrew facilitates EY's injury schemes focus within the actuarial services division. So that sounds very impressive, very good. So Peter's going to kick off, followed by Andrew, and Bevan's going to wrap up at about 10 minutes each, and hopefully have 10 minutes for questions at the end. So Peter, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce. So I don't expect people to agree with all our views in this paper. I think some of the comments we're going to make may be a little bit controversial, but that's fine. What we're trying to do is get a bit of a debate going. So I'm going to look at why are we looking at this topic. Andrew's going to look at what did we do, what were our findings, and then Bevan's going to put it all together. So why look at the role of the regulator? Well, I suppose there's a bit of a background. I guess particularly the work I've been doing the last few years. I've had lots of discussions with regulators, scheme managers, whatever you want to call them, around their role. And there's actually quite a diverse practices around and diverse views. So when we talk about the role of the regulator, we are not referring to what is in the legislation, but rather how schemes actually carry out their role, or if you want to call it manage their business. And we are using the term regulator fairly broadly, recognising that we actually have three different models operating in Australia, privately underwritten, monopolies, and hybrids, where the claims management at least is outsourced to providers. This makes it a bit of a difficult topic now to deal with because of those three different models. It did strike us in doing the research how widely different views are between the schemes and also between the insurers and agents. Since the GFC internationally, there's been more of a focus, a lot of commentary more generally around regulation. It's actually had been a pretty hot topic. We've also seen, internationally, I guess there's been a view, this is my interpretation, that regulators need to be more active, more proactive, and intrusive into the organisations that they regulate. There's been a move to more transparency, accountability for performance, and the focus on efficiency of schemes. Now, personally, I've seen APRA evolve as a regulator since in the last 14 and 15 years, from what I would consider is a very light-touch regulator to a situation now where they're actually very much more proactive regulator. I wouldn't necessarily say they're intrusive, but they're very much more proactive. We need to recognise that injury schemes and APRA have different mandates, and that's an important differentiator. So you can't just translate what APRA does and the way they approach their regulatory role into these schemes. It seems to me, having been around the schemes for many years, that there really has been limited changes in the regulation and management of schemes over time. It doesn't mean there hasn't been changes, but there hasn't been really any significant changes. And there seems to be a wide spectrum of different approaches in these schemes between the regulation and the management of them and how they undertake their roles. We've had some pretty healthy discussions in the work we've done and the interviews we've conducted. And it seems to me that many schemes have been considering how they should better manage or undertake their role over time. We are not proposing a model. We're not proposing there's a best way to do this, but rather asking some questions that we think schemes and stakeholders and service providers need to consider. And everyone has a different view about this. One of the important things is, where's the right balance? And I think the balance is actually important. I don't know where the right balance is for most of the schemes, but it's something that's actually pretty important. It's short-term versus long-term. You know, you've got to balance the needs of claimants versus premium payers. Between the various service providers, it's going to be hands-on or very, to the right, very hands-on, proactive, intrusive, whatever. There's so many different variations. So if we continue on the next slide, let's look at my little notes here. I guess there's always been a focus on benefit design around their schemes. But what I've actually come to the view, there are actually some very other important matters why these schemes run for a scheme to be successful. In a way, sometimes I think too much attention has been paid to benefit design. It is always the thing that needs to change. When I think sometimes what schemes need to think about is how their schemes are being managed and regulated. Sometimes that can actually, if you get it right, be the answer rather than just going to Parliament and wanting legislation changed. What makes these schemes different to other forms of insurance? They are subject to a public interest test. This is something Andrew Nicholls has actually made a big thing about. These are compulsory schemes for both the, for the premium payers. And so there really is a public interest test that they need to meet. And sometimes I actually think that doesn't actually get enough attention. How schemes are managed and how they undertake their role is really important. Has a large impact on achieving government and scheme objectives. Can have a major impact on the culture of the scheme. And in the claims management session, I talked a bit about that. It has a major impact on how claimants behave, premium payers behave, how service providers, and I include insurers here, behave. And it's a really important issue in our view as to how these schemes undertake their role. So I won't go through this. This is, you know, basically saying that there's different three different models and scattered both throughout CDP and workers. Different scheme models, the three models, they each have different issues to address. I wouldn't pretend that any of this is easy, because it's not. And there are different views, and sometimes none of them are right or none of them are wrong. Scheme objectives are not always black and white. Sometimes they are in conflict. And a good example is, in a CDP scheme, most schemes, or the new one in New South Wales, has an objective to have affordability, but also has equity. Now, if you had all the premiums were equitable, you'd have people paying thousands of dollars. But that's not affordable. So they're actually in conflict. So this paper is not necessarily around our views, but it's about having a debate. What do we mean by regulation? Not black letter law regulation. It's about how the scheme undertake their role within their letters of constraints. I'm not talking about day-to-day management. We also recognise that how schemes are managed will be impacted by the political masters and the constraints those political masters place on the regulators or the scheme managers. So Andrew is going to take over and talk about what we did.
afternoon, everyone. So Peter talked a bit about us working with a whole range of schemes and also with some insurers over a broad history. I guess the additional thing that we did, other than collate our own views and some of the insights we had, was we went out and interviewed a whole bunch of regulators or representatives from regulators across the three different scheme designs, and also some of the insurers slash agents that operate in there. And we tried to nut down on a few specific types of issues, which we've listed over there in topics, to try and sort of get a bit of conversation around what are some of the practical things that come out there. So I guess the first one is around approach to regulation. I think it's fair to say that the type of regulator that the government wants will be influenced by the regulatory environment set up in the legislation. Certainly in terms of specific powers the legislation gives to the regulator and the realm of flexibility delegated to the regulator. We spoke to a number of representatives and we talked to them about intrusive versus light touch regulation or hands-on, hands-off or reactive, proactive. Now, a lot of these words, the common thing is that they're all subjective and there's no clear-cut definition of what each of them mean or which one is right, which one's wrong. Some of them have negative connotations, but I guess there's no clear-cut definition on them. So another issue that also came out in our discussions is that when we talk about sort of regulation or hands-on, hands-off, it's hard to steer clear of like the day-to-day management from the insurance end. So we tried as much as possible to separate the two and say we want to talk about the regulatory functions as opposed to the management or insurance day-to-day management. And Bevan will actually touch on a bit of that and bring that together a bit later from a functions point of view. There also appeared to be a bit of a lack of clarity with some organisations that have both that regulation and management function in the one organisation as to what the roles are that need to be there or what separate they are. And again, we do acknowledge that that's a viewpoint as to what fits in where, but we definitely saw a bit of confusion about or lack of clarity as to what fits where. So I guess one thing that we could deduce from talking about light touch regulation is that it makes certain assumptions that the service providers, so primarily the insurers, but I guess it can extend even broader from that, that the assumptions are that they're all doing the right thing by the scheme is kind of the priority assumption when you're applying some kind of light touch regulation. And then on the other side of that, our discussions also reflected that light touch regulation can often be can result in a significant delay before issues are actually noticed and then rectified within a scheme. So that was definitely something that came across. So on internal people capabilities, the question here is about what types of experience and skill sets do you need for a regulator and how do you attract and retain these skill sets and motivate performance? In a lot of regulators, we noticed that resources were skewed towards fixing things rather than, I guess, being a bit more proactive or applying strategic intent. There can be a historical focus for why that's happening, or it can be a lack of resources, effectively, so you can't actually practically go out there and be proactive because you don't really have much resources to work with. The other issue that came up was that turnover and change of management were identified as issues that materially impact that kind of stuff that comes up, and especially that has an influence on the performance of the scheme. There was some sense in the industry that when a new regulatory management team comes in, it takes maybe 3 years or even by a second term of government before they actually start to understand how the scheme's working and therefore what kind of the key issues they need to drill down on. So I guess then once we got through a few of these things, we also started talking about what kind of competencies do we think we need for effective regulators. The first one's stakeholder and change management, to be able to collaboratively implement and reform and change. Engagement or influential skills to be perceived to be knowledgeable within the scheme and also in government and to be able to affect direction. Strategic capability, to shift the focus away from operational compliance or fixing things and general reactiveness to then elevate the role in terms of improving outcomes, sustainability and certainty of costs. And finally, technical competence, so whether that's statistical, actuarial or going into areas like fraud detection, whatnot. One of the key issues we talked about was whether private insurance industry experience is required within a regulator. Noting that regulators or the organisations that have regulators often have the insurance element, we tried to drill down on that issue, and it was decided that some of the viewpoints were around, yes, for that insurance function, for the functions that are there, yes, that would definitely benefit from private industry insurance experience, but the regulatory function doesn't include those insurance functions, so it's not necessary that the private insurance industry experience is going to help out there. So that was just a viewpoint that we kind of got to through our discussions, or drilling down on that issue. Some people actually noted that different models, like in the US, they do attract private industry experience. They pay for it, whereas there's some practical issues in trying to pay for it over here because there's a bit of a disparity between government salaries and private industry. Okay, I'll move on to the next issue. So in terms of regulating and managing service providers, everyone has acknowledged that, or regulators acknowledge this difficult task. We'll talk specifically about medical and legal. It's fair to say that there's a fair bit of variation in how regulators regulate medical service providers. One example is by setting limits on rates for service, or even the services themselves that can be charged for. The regulator can often align fee schedules with another scheme, might even be in the same state, so if it's CTP, they could use workers' comp or vice versa, or even with the national schedule, or use AMA or something like that. If the rates are specific to the scheme, the regulator might negotiate increases each year with a panel of medical service provider representatives, or they might want to avoid the negotiation issues and just simply implement their own indexing approach to bypass that. In terms of service utilisation, the best approach we've kind of seen the best proactive approach we've seen is where the regulator's got an internal analytics team, and they're sitting there sort of trying to understand, all right, where are their outliers in terms of the service providers, and then sort of passing that on to like fraud detection or whatever relevant team to take action on that. But it's fair to say that whilst that's probably the best approach we've seen, that a number of regulators, whether it's constrained by resources or whatnot, are fairly reactive when it comes to service utilisation monitoring. So they only sort of approach issues if it's pointed out to them by an insurer, an agent or whatever. Okay. Moving on to legal service providers. It was fairly unanimous from our discussions that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to regulate legal service providers. It came across that it's often a scheme design flaw, or it's something that needs to be addressed through the scheme design to regulate legal service providers. So I guess what we're saying is the ability of the legal service providers to flourish within the scheme is dependent on whatever levers they can play on, such as their allowance for legal advertising, or whether there's the existence of more than one insurer and therefore some potential inconsistencies in approach to, say, claims management or something like that they can then go and pick on. So it definitely came across that it was somewhat more of a scheme design issue in terms of dealing with the lawyers. People might not agree with me on that. I completely understand that. Moving on to relationships and culture, I guess at a high level, the type of regulator you are and the method you operate with will very much influence the culture within the scheme, and that's across both stakeholders, so the premium payers and the claimants, as well as the service providers, so the insurers, the medical, legal, whatnot. Some regulators view enforcement as a last resort of regulation, so basically their presence within the scheme sort of negates the need to actually take action there because they've set something by precedent. Definitely something that you can see that is dependent on the culture within the scheme and sort of how much their stance is in the market. If we first talk about claimants in the scheme, we've noticed in the past with some government underwritten schemes that have applied a light-touch regulation approach or seemingly light-touch with some sort of form of compliance-driven insurance management approach, that often that kind of approach can lead to a social welfare entitlements-type culture within by claimants. And I guess that kind of culture can lead to further issues down the track, whether it's deficits, blowouts and whatnot, and it's harder to sort of deal with those kind of issues without making rash moves. So I guess it's a classic case of why the understanding why the regulation and the way that you approach the regulation can actually significantly impact the culture within the scheme and therefore the performance of the scheme. In terms of the relationships with insurers and agents, from our discussions, it's fair to assume that the relationship with the regulator and the insurers and agents is a professional one. There is, however, differences that do come up based on the different vested interests that are in there, and those differences can often be exacerbated by how well the two communicate, which is probably not something that's news to everyone here. Insurers, the comment was that they do not take well to apparent randomness by regulators. Most regulators, I would say, at least claim to employ a consultative approach when they implement change, or whether it's small change, big change. However, not all service providers would claim that those regulators do that. And I guess in trying to wrap that up, one thing that's certain about it is that whenever change is to be implemented, the regulator faces the challenge of having to bring the service providers on the journey with them. And I guess from the regulator's point of view, there's challenges no matter what approach is adopted. Take, for example, a regulator that's perceived to be relatively hands-off and doesn't intrude on operations for a number of years, they can set a behavioural expectation as to what they how they perform or how they expect things to run. And then the minute that they want to change the ball game on that, it's actually quite difficult to do because they've set that behavioural expectation. Whereas if you take the opposite side and you say that, you know, a regulator that's intrusive and continues to be sort of hands-on in every aspect. Well, aside from the issues that probably causes on the insurance, and it's actually quite tiresome for the regulator to do that because no one really wants to go around and sort of regulate with a big stick all the time. It's actually quite daunting to be able to do that. So I guess we're back at sort of where do we find the right balance between it? Okay, just one more page, so... Sorry, Bevan. So the last one's about innovation. So the question was, what should the regulator be doing in innovation versus what the insurer is doing? There was some feeling in the industry that it's not really the role of the regulator to be involved in or directly involved in innovation, that innovation should sit with the insurer, and that's whether it's a government model or private model, any of the models. It was acknowledged that that's something across both. There's a belief that regulators can often stymie attempts at innovation or set it back by 18 months, 24 months. There was examples of it given around that, but I think I'll leave them out for now. A common view is that the regulator, rather than being directly involved in innovation, they should provide an environment that's conducive to innovation to allow the insurers or insurer to innovate as opposed to actually get directly involved. There were also some comments around if the regulator attempts to facilitate an exchange of innovation, then that's got long-term consequences for the scheme in that the insurers won't be or the insurer won't be sort of conducive to wanting to invest in innovation going forward because they won't see any value for it. Notwithstanding these comments, there's no apparent reason why the regulator can't be innovative within their own realm, so within their own capabilities and their own organisation. And the final note on that is that there's some structural impediments to innovation in the long term for a monopoly insurer, particularly relevant to government monopolies. There's a practical issue in terms of trying to incentivise or motivate staff to perform at their best ability when the organisation's not competing with other competitors or competing on returns. I know that's a bit controversial, but I'll just end it there. Bevan, do you want to take off?
I'm standing between lunch. And I'm hungry too. Okay, so we'll try and leave a few minutes for questions. I've got about 8 minutes to go. So, where did we get to? My job, put it all together. So, when we interviewed all the schemes, agents, insurers, The information was just here. We've dug through a bit of that detail, but how do you put that into a structured way of thinking? I'm an engineer. I kind of like to do a bit of structured thinking. Helps me process through, work out what I'm doing. So what we came up with was, well, there seems to be confusion about what's the function of the regulator. Does the regulator know what function they should be doing? Where should the functions within the scheme reside? Are some regulatory functions, are some insurer functions, are some regulatory function or regulator functions that can be outsourced? But if we look around, first of all, around the outside, there's some clear elements that need to be done. Who's designing, administering, supervising and enforcing a scheme? That's pretty much the regulator. Who's managing? Who's delivering the scheme? That's pretty much the insurance function within a scheme. But if we look across schemes, we actually see some schemes are primarily a single fund. So if we look at TAC, there's an example there. Single fund. Where's the regulator in TAC? Actually, there's a little bit of that in the Victorian government, and they kind of sit up there. And then a lot of that regulatory function is outsourced into TAC. If we look at Western Australian Workers' Comp, what we see is that is the regulator, and they regulate a bunch of insurers who operate in a competitive environment. So what I want to do is just pick on one example from each of the three areas here, and then what we'll do is explore a little bit about the concept that Peter talked about being active or passive in managing those functions. So the three I want to pick on is market design. So who sets that up? Pretty much should be the regulator, don't we think? It's setting it out. What's the market going to look like? Is it going to be competitive? Is it going to have insurers? Is it going to be a single fund? Government may do that in legislation. Well, who actually helps write the legislation? Pretty much it's the regulator. So we think that's probably a regulatory function. The next one I want to pick, pretty obvious one I think, claims management. Who does that? Well, it's pretty much an insurance function as well. Well, it's an insurance function. It's fairly obvious that it should sit there. There's probably rules around how it might be done. The regulator might say, here's some guidelines. We don't want you to be too nasty when you're doing that claims management. But ultimately, the function of it probably resides in insurance function. If we look at the grey area in the middle, the one I picked out, service providers. So there was a bit of debate in our group about what elements of service provision. Is it really a regulator that does that, or is it an insurer? What I look at is, and having worked in health insurance for quite a few years, the regulators in health insurance don't actually care about service providers. They say to the insurers, well, you deal with it, we don't care. In schemes, we actually see a bit of a mixture there, because we think maybe some providers are taking us for granted, not doing the right thing by claimants, by the schemes. And so regulators there might go, well, we'll set some rules up, and then to manage them, we may actually give that to an insurer, or we might outsource it to a third party to actually provide that management function. So if we dig through a little bit and look at how we might deal with some of those functions. And I've chosen three, again, a little bit different. They're all a little bit different. So let's choose data. Where do we perform this function and how do we perform it? From a regulator's point of view, we can either be light touch, collect a bit of data, limited data, we don't really publish too much, or we can be quite proactive about doing that. We collect comprehensive data at the regulator level, policy data, claims data, we de-identify it and we push it back out. So structurally though, there can be impediments, and the one I choose is common law, for example. We do settlements, and while the settlement and might be put into boxes about the head of damage, that's an estimate about the future. And what we don't actually see, and we never see, is where did that money actually end up? So we have a picture of what it looked like before settlement, and we have a picture of the estimation of settlement, but we don't actually see where the money ended up. So that's the first example. The second one, monitoring, and Andrew went across some of these functions in a bit of detail. So really what we're looking at is, do you want to be a reactive or a proactive regulator around monitoring of your scheme? And we've certainly seen examples of both in our work. So what there might be is, are there restrictions on what you can do in your within your regulator. So financial restrictions, the government's putting on your headcount, financial impediments. So what you might do is outsource it, or you might do it in a limited way. Alternatively, you may well build up a strong team that understands internally and collects and analyses quite regularly that information, and brings that up to the management, up to board level, with insights and understanding, and they can actually drive the behaviour of the scheme sitting behind that. And I am rushing, I'm sorry. So the final one I want to touch on is service providers. Again, this is the common one that I pulled out before. What you can do is you can inherently create passive or active behaviour depending on how you set up the structure of your service providers. So what I'd suggest is if you set up a panel of providers, that's actually creating a structure where inherently it's more active than passive, because through that panel process you've actually put some regulation around it. You've checked what they do, you've checked their professional credentials and provided some vetting as a minimum. What you may also do is through their colleges, so college GPs, is every 6 months you have a visit with that college. That sets an implicit message to all those providers working with your scheme that you're watching what they're doing and you're interested in what they're doing and how they're doing it. And that means you're being proactive more than passive. So if I wrap up, we have two key questions out of all of that research that we did that really we came down to, which is, what functions do you want to be performing as a regulator? Let's work out and be clear about those functions, where they reside, and how do you want to be doing those functions? And you can choose to do different functions in different ways. You can be very strong on some functions and you can be passive on others because you don't think they matter for your scheme. So I think I'd better wrap up there and we'll go for questions. Thanks very much.
Alan Clayton. I suppose my response that this is a very Linnaean or taxonomic approach, a bit like how you'd classify plants or butterflies. And there is a very rich, extensive and rich literature on regulation. At ANU, John Braithwaite has succeeded in getting 6 chairs in the RegNet network on regulation. So on some of the issues, such as the tensions between light touch and more interventionist, there is a concept of responsive regulation in which the level of intervention would vary according to the degree of compliance or recalcitrance in that. So, I mean, in terms of having debate, I think that a lot of the richness, the nuanced, the shades of grey have been missed in this by not settling within any theoretical framework or a framework which allows the exploration of these highly nuanced situations. Now, I may not have taken my anti-grumpy pills this morning, but...
Kim Birch from the Motor Accident Insurance Commission, and I am a regulator. Just a comment, building on the point before about the Galbraith work. I mean, Professor Malcolm Sparrow is another one that is well researched and well respected in the field of regulation, and the regulatory craft is something that I flick through late at night on many nights. So I think the point is you've got to have a regulatory framework. That's the point. You've got to look at what your functions are, but your framework must, supporting the previous comment, be able to ebb and flow in relation to whether it does need a light touch or a more aggressive touch. It also has to, I think, in this environment that we're in of looking at what's called red tape reduction or looking at simplification for businesses, and we're challenging ourselves and looking at how much you've got to find the balance. What is the right amount? You know, is it? And you've got to find that sweet spot, but be prepared to dig in deep on issues. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being reactive in a proactive way. So using your BI to really be able to know your scheme, know whether something's trending, brewing, and jump on it and pull it apart and respond accordingly to that issue. Not create a whole new set of laws to deal with it. And working really hard with your stakeholders, be it your licensed insurers in Queensland, your legal profession, your providers, and your other government departments. So I think that it's horses for courses. There's a lot of political oversight and overlay on how a jurisdiction would respond. But it's about finding what your objective is, what your functions are, what you've been mandated to do, and work within your mandate, but also work a little bit to the right, looking to the harm aspects that you can see that perhaps you're not mandated to get involved in, but how you can influence. And that was a big blah, but that's my view.
I might add, Kim, that does echo many of the people that we interviewed, and it is, well, there's no right answer to this, and in this situation we're going to do this, and in that situation we're going to do that. So we actually saw people moving across that spectrum, so there's no question that that makes a sensible approach, but I guess you've got to start somewhere, and you've got to start with an argument somewhere, and then go from there.
Probably have time for one more. No, everybody's hungry. All right. So seeing that you've bought yourself an extra minute, the door is locked right now. You have to fill out your evaluation forms for this session before you leave. And while you're doing that, in the interest of efficiency, I will thank our three speakers, Peter and Bevan and Andrew, for their presentation.